Thank you. Wow, I am going to break a rule. So when I teach public speaking, I say, never come up before an audience and start by saying, I'm so glad to be here today. Because nobody's going to believe you. And the reason they're not going to believe you is because everybody says, I'm so glad to be here. Such an honor to be here. And if you want somebody to believe you when you say that, you got to wait for 5 minutes and then say it a little bit in. And then when you say, you know, and by the way, I'm happy to be here, and they're going to believe you then. But I'm going to break the rule, and I'm going to start by saying, I'm really glad to be here today. You know why? Because I was here last week, and I had a good time. Plus, I didn't finish the meal, right? Or I should say, you didn't finish the meal. I'm serving the meal. And I made a promise to you last week of what you'll get in 2 weeks. I haven't fulfilled the promise, so I want to finish up. And I know some of you weren't here last week. How many were not here, just out of curiosity? Where were you? Hospital? That's no excuse. Man, oh man. Okay, so what I want to do is I want to try to bring the rest of you a little bit up to speed on what we covered last week, and this will also serve as a bit of a refresher for the rest of you who were here last week. So helpful. You know, before you start, it's another thing about being a professional speaker is you get your notes in order, right? And I thought I had them all in order, and then I'm looking down and I'm missing a page. Thank you very much. Where was I? All right. Oh, wait, I know how to fix that. It's called a paperclip. Okay, we'll take care of this right now. Thank you. Okay. I made a promise to you. I actually made a prediction and then a promise, and the prediction was in light of the promise that I planned to fulfill. And the prediction was that many of you would look back on last week and this week, taken conjointly, the material that you learn and put into play, I predicted, would change your life. That is, if you look back on this weekend, these 2 weekends, you will think back and say, those were the weekends when everything changed for me. That's when it all came together, the way that I could most effectively engage other people with the claims of Christ. Now, there is a little caveat on this. And I'll tell you right now, the last service did not do well. So I gave you assignment last week to carry out, based on what I taught you last week, practicing until this week, and I asked for a show of hands last service, how many people did it? So I'm just going to do it again. Remember, God's watching. So how many people went out and used the question and practiced the first step of our game plan last week? One, two, three, four, five, six. Got a pencil and paper? Write this down. Ready? If you don't do it, write it down. If you don't do it, it don't work. If you don't do it, it don't work. Church is not, friends, brothers and sisters, church is not a time to get together and just be encouraged for a couple of hours and leave. It is a time for training. It is a time for learning how to live out there in all kinds of different ways, and this is one of those ways. Now, some of you are here, and you're not followers of Christ, and you're visiting, and I'm really glad you're here, but I'm not talking to you. This session is for Christians to get trained to be better Christians. And some of you non-Christians visiting are thinking, I'm all for that. So that you can learn things here and go out. These are not evangelistic meetings. These are for the ecclesia, the called out ones who come together on a regular basis to be built up and to be trained to make a difference out there. That's where evangelism and Christian living is done. This is a detail of that, so I'm giving you a game plan. And thank you for each of those. And I know there are more of you practice than raise your hand, because some people just are a little timid about raising your hand. But the rule is, if you don't do it, it don't work. And that is true about every single area of the Christian life, okay? So let me give you a quick update, because what I was trying to do is give you a different perspective on the whole enterprise that we usually refer to as evangelism. I want you to think rather not being an evangelist, but being an ambassador, because I want your engagements with other people to kind of feel more like diplomacy than D-Day. And a lot of times our engagements look like D-Day because there's a lot of conflict, and I want you to avoid that for your sake and for theirs and for the gospel's sake. Because when you're fighting, you know, it's hard to change minds when you're in that kind of a mode. And I suggest that maybe there's something missing in the way we engage. That people like me who train in this kind of stuff over the years haven't really given you. And that is a missing bridge from the content of the information that we learn in church, or maybe read in books, or we go to a seminar that teaches us how to answer challenges and how to engage people. We get really good information, okay? But what's missing is this bridge from the content to the conversation. This bridge from the scholarship to the relationship. How do you get that information into play, into a friendly conversation with somebody who needs the information? So that's the task. I want to provide that bridge, okay? And I said that it requires, to some degree, we need to rethink our approach, because the world has changed, the culture has changed in the last 50 years. I became a Christian 45 years ago during the Jesus movement. And when I did, pretty much witnessing what we called it then, evangelism, just going out and sharing a simple gospel and praying with people to receive Christ. So you go out in the evening, and then you come back, and you see how many people became Christians. That was a big deal then. Still is, obviously. But that thing happened back then, because that's the way the culture was. It was tuned for it. The Holy Spirit was moving in a certain way. Plus, the culture understood the language. They understood what we were talking about when we talked about Jesus and sin and salvation and God and all that other stuff. Just a matter of putting the pieces together and kind of coming forward. That's all change. Things are different now. People don't understand. You tell them the basics of Christianity, people not only not understand it, they get angry. It bugs them. Okay, it's a very different scene now. Okay? And so I taught you, in light of the fact that things have changed, we have to somewhat change our perspective. And instead of, and this is what I suggested to you, that is somewhat controversial. It reflects my own change. And that being that I don't go out anywhere, anytime, to win anybody to Christ. And what I mean by that, so it's not misunderstood, is that whenever I get in a conversation with an individual person, I don't have it as a goal in that conversation to get them to sign on the dotted line the way I used to. I'm not trying to close the deal, okay? I'm not swinging for the fences, okay? I have a different goal. And it's based on something that I realized that part of the nature of the process, and I had you write this down. Some of you might remember it. And here's what I said. Help me out. Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of gardening. Okay, you got it. Before there can be any harvest, there always has to be a season of gardening. In other words, if you became a follower of Jesus sometime in your adult life, even in your own life, you realize that the harvest in your life, the time you made a decision, a commitment to follow, that came after a season of thinking about it, hearing about it, pushing back maybe, asking questions, all of those things, okay? Nowadays, that's always true, incidentally. Nowadays, that season is a lot longer, though. And we see Jesus talking about this in John chapter 4, I mentioned that, how he says that there are some who harvest, but there are some who sow. And in that case, the disciples were going to harvest where they did not sow. And so we learn from Jesus an obvious point, really. And actually, many of his points were fairly commonsensical, obvious. That's why they're so powerful. He's pointing out some of the obvious. He said, there, in any field, there is going to be two seasons. There's going to be a gardening season, then there's going to be a harvesting season, okay? Which means you need two kinds of workers. You need gardeners and you need some harvesters. And by the way, since harvesting happens when the fruit is ripe, harvesting, generally speaking, is relatively what? Easy. You just pluck it. There it is. I mean, there's labor involved, but it's not hard. It's ready to go. Okay? The hard work is in the gardening, and there's a whole lot more gardeners than there are harvesters usually. Or I should say the time is there, because that's where the work needs to be done. And in our culture, we need more of what Francis Schaeffer used to call pre-evangelism. Okay, so as I'm reflecting in my own life, and so this is what I last week was suggesting to you. Gee, if we need more gardeners, I look in my own life, I realize that what I do professionally even is mostly gardening. Whether it's speaking like this or writing or any of the radio or any of those other things that I've been involved with, most of what I'm doing is gardening in people's lives. And I'm happy to do that. And if I garden, and then you come along and pick the ripe fruit out of my garden, do I mind? No. We're on the same team. As Jesus said in John 4, so the one who sows, gardeners, and the one who reaps can rejoice together. Once again, one field, two seasons, two kinds of workers, one happy team, okay? And so as I started thinking about that, oh, well, I'm gardening. Well, then I began, and the way the culture has changed, I began to change my goal. And so instead of having a goal of trying to win people to Christ, I made a more modest goal, broadly gardening, but I used a phrase to describe it, okay? And what was the phrase I used to describe what I'm trying to do in any given conversation? Put a stone in somebody's shoe, right? So, like when I speak to a non-Christian audience, I tell them right up front, look, I'm not here to convert you, okay? I'm not going to be harvesting, okay? I just want to annoy you a little bit in a good way. All right? I just want you to be thinking about something I've said because I think Jesus is worth thinking about. And frankly, friends, if I can accomplish that in any conversation, I'm satisfied. If that's I shoot for that, I'm lowering my expectation, and therefore there's a greater chance I'm going to move forward, for one, get off the bench. Same thing with you. Get off the bench if you have a lower expectation. And once you fulfill that lower expectation, sometimes it goes further, all right? You never know what the Lord is going to do. So I have as a goal just to put a stone in someone's shoe, to try in a conversation in a friendly way, to do some gardening, to get them thinking about something in a spiritual thing. Now, sometimes that might mean that I'm making a positive point for my view somehow. It may be that I am raising questions or whatever that causes them to question their own view somehow. I don't know in any given situation, but these are different ways that I might put a little stone in someone's shoe. So that's what I'm after, okay? But how do I accomplish that? I have a game plan. And the game plan is what I promised to give to you. A game plan that will allow you to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you know, or how knowledgeable or aggressive or even obnoxious the other person happens to be. That was the promise I made, and I began laying the foundation for that last week. The game plan follows a guideline that Paul gives in Colossians 4, so let me revisit his words. Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6, and here's what Paul said. He said, conduct yourself with wisdom towards outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. All right, that's the first thing. Okay, in other words, be smart. Then he says, let your speech always be with grace, right? seasoned as it were with salt. So be smart, be nice. And then he adds, so that you know how to respond to each person. Okay? So he says, be smart, be nice, be tactical. Treat human beings as individuals. Engage on a personal level. Make it real for them individually. But how do you do that? That's where the game plan comes in. It's called a tactical game plan. I've written a book about it. The book is called Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions. The worship leader, remember I told you last week, people are always talking to me about this book. They come back and they help. The worship leader told me at the end of the last service, just 20 minutes ago, hour, whatever it was, right after. No, just after he stepped down. He said, I keep buying these things for my friends all the time because they're such a help. He's found it for himself, and he knows it's going to be for others. So what I'm going to give you now, books are available in the back if you want to get one. And there's also a DVD training set where you can actually have a group of people do it if you want to. And you can get a workbook over at Amazon for that. But the point is, I'm going to give you the basics of it. I started last week. And at Standard Reason, we have lots of different tactics. They have names like steamroller and taking the roof off and just the facts, ma'am, and suicide and, you know, things like these are all maneuvers that will allow you to be effective in conversation. But they all serve a larger game plan. The game plan is an individual tactic. That tactic has a name. And the name of the tactic that's the core of the game plan I began to teach you last week is what? Columbo, right, after the infamous Lieutenant Columbo, and we talked a little bit about that. Some of you may not recall him, but he's the guy who showed up in the crime scene and begins asking lots of questions. So we're using Lieutenant Columbo as a guide, using questions to stay in the driver's seat of the conversation. And what questions turn out to be is really handy because they're easy to ask, and when you ask other people questions about their own views, this is friendly. So you've got good manners when you're doing that. There's no pressure. There's no difficulty. You're drawing other people out. Basically, what we're looking for is we're looking for information about the other person in general and also about their ideas. That's the two broad categories, okay? So the use of questions represents the steps in our game plan. I mentioned that there are actually three steps to our game plan, and last week I gave you the first step, and today I'm going to give you the second step. Now, what I mean by first step, and I'll review it a little bit, what I mean by first step is, since it's a game plan, that means when you get into play, this is the plan you use. You think first about your first step and not about any other steps. The first thing that you're going to do is gather information. So that was the first use of our game plan. First, we're going to gather information. We're going to get intel. We're going to get the lay of the land, so to speak, okay? And we have a model question that we are going to ask in order to do that. Anybody remember that model question? What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Now, that's a model question. That is, there are a lot of variations. I told last week about my conversation with the witch in Wisconsin who was wearing that five-pointed star, the pentagram, and it caught my attention. And so I asked her, does that jewelry have religious significance? So that is a kind of a what do you mean by that question, but it was also the pleasant, friendly, relaxed entree into a longer conversation that you might recall that we had that we ended up talking about abortion, as it turned out. Now, why did it go that way? I don't know. Why did you talk? Some people say, why did you decide to go that way? I didn't decide to go that way. I was just following what was given me, if you get the sense. And since I asked the question, then I just saw what the Lord made available, and that's the direction that I ended up going. Now, there's lots of different ways to use this question. Remember, what do you mean by that is a question that will gather information about the person and especially gather information about that person's objections to Christianity. So there are lots of times where people will push back with a challenge, all right? And there are ambiguities in the challenge, And we get stuck because we think, I got to answer the challenge, instead of pressing for more clarity in what the person means. And I know some of you are thinking, look, I didn't like the challenge the first time around. I'm not going to want to hear him say it again with more detail, right? But I'm telling you, when you ask for more detail, it really helps you, okay? That first question, what do you mean by that, is going to be especially good when people raise questions like, as I gave as an example last week, everything is relative, okay? So I encourage you, instead of trying to answer the challenge, to ask the question, what do you mean by relative, or what do you mean by everything? Either case. Now, I'd mentioned last week that I'd written a book on relativism, and that was a mistake, because when folks went back to the book table, they were looking for that book, which is really nice, except I didn't bring any. So this week, I brought a bunch of relativism books. They're back there if you want to get it, okay? So I know what relativism is, but I don't know that the other person who says that everything's relative knows anything about relativism. Why is that? It's because people repeat what they hear, not what they've thought about, what they hear. And if they repeat what they hear in a way that is convenient or effective for them, say in the case of just stopping a Christian in his tracks, they don't need to know anything. All they need to know is a slogan. They say the slogan, their work is done. Okay? So this is what I'm concerned about here. All right? I don't want other people just to say stuff and you get stuck. I want you to go further and ask them what they mean by that. Okay, so now we're going to have a little test. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to toss out some ideas here. We'll do a little audience interactive response kind of, so you can see how this plays out. It's not that hard. So if somebody says, well, what about all the evil in the world? You'll say, what do you mean by that? Okay, that's the good generic response. Now, if you wanted to dial it down a little bit more, you might say, what exactly is the problem? Now, why would I say that? Don't I think there's a problem of evil? Of course I think there's a problem to be answered, but I don't want to be the one to have to articulate it. If somebody says, what about all the evil in the world? I could say, well, what is the problem? Then I want them to spell it out. Let them do the heavy lifting to articulate their own view. Now, this is going to have a remarkable effect. When they are forced to talk through the details of their own view, it forces them to think about it more often, more thoroughly, and it also gives you something more to work with. For example, I might even ask, what do you mean by evil? Well, you know, murder, rape, torture, that kind of stuff. And I'm going to stop by and say, well, wait a minute. You've just given me examples of evil. You haven't told me why those things are evil. Okay, well, they've never thought about that before. Now, I realize this is a little bit of an advanced step, but I'm trying to figure out, what is it that makes evil things evil and good things good? You got to have some kind of standard, and you're not going to get very far in this conversation without getting close to God. I'm just telling you. Okay? So this is one way for me to move forward there. How about if somebody said, do you take the Bible literally? You say? Somebody says, sure. See, now I had a different response to the first audience. You guys were more careful. I think this guy's tricky. I'm not saying anything. What I said to the last service, I said, do you guys take the Bible literally? And almost everybody said, yes, but this is the wrong answer. Now, I know what you mean by that. I know what you're getting at. You take the Bible seriously. You take the Bible as God's word, inspired and inerrant. I'm with you on that. But the Bible says that Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches. Is he a bush? No, so you see the problem there. So if somebody says, do you take the Bible literally, you should be asking, what do you mean by literally? Then let them explain. Then you can give a more precise answer, you see. So you're not going to get yourself into a jam, right? Do you believe in evolution? My. Okay, let me start over. Since we've already been talking for 14 minutes. Do you believe in evolution? What do you mean by that? Do you know there are all kinds of definitions to evolution? Do you think that my theology has evolved since I first became a Christian? I hope so. I've learned a few things. Now, there are lots of different kinds of evolution, even in biology. You got to clarify, what do you mean by that? Okay? Let's see. Somebody says believing in God is irrational. What do you mean by irrational? In what way? Exactly. In what way is it irrational? Specify for me where belief in God goes awry in terms of thinking. Let me know. Okay? Science has proved there is no God. What do you mean by that? Some variation. Specifically, how has science done that? Tell me the details. You always want the details. Because it's easy to get by with a slogan. It is much harder to fill in the spaces, and you don't have to do that. They have to do that. It is their claim. Okay, so there's a couple of examples about how that might play out. All right. Let's move to the second step of the game plan. So now we've reviewed the first step. We are going to try to put a stone in people's shoes, do a little gardening, and we're going to use questions to do that, so there's no pressure on us, but it keeps us in the driver's seat. The first thing we're going to do is gather information using some form of the question, what do you mean by that? Here's the second step of the game plan. The second step is we are going to reverse the burden of proof. Just go ahead and write that down, and I'll explain what it is. We are going to reverse the burden of proof. Now, what is the burden of proof? The burden of proof is the responsibility somebody in a conversation has that's controversial. It's the responsibility somebody has to give reasons for a view, okay? So who is it in any conversation who has the responsibility to give reasons? Who is it that bears the burden of proof? And here's the answer. The person who makes the claim bears the burden. The person who makes the claim bears the burden. That is, if you claim something is so, especially if it's controversial, then you have a responsibility to give reasons why you think it's so. All right? It is not the responsibility of the other person to disprove you if you're making the claim. All right? So the DA comes and knocks on your door. And he says, you robbed a bank. And what do you say? Prove it. Last service, somebody said, which one? No, I didn't rob that one. I robbed the other one. You got the wrong bank. Really? Okay. Yeah, prove it. Because in American jurisprudence, the burden of proof is on the accuser. Same principle here. Okay, now how does that apply in our conversations? For far too long, Christians have heard a challenge. People have said something. Well, there is no God. Well, the Bible's been changed. Well, evolution is true. Well, Jesus never existed, or he didn't work miracles, or that was added to the Bible. All kinds of claims they have made against Christianity, which is fine. I have no objections to that. But what the Christian usually does is they feel that they have the responsibility to refute the challenge, and they can't do it. So they're dead in the water. They can't answer all of these things, most people. They don't know how. So they're stuck. And the other side, in a certain sense, wins by default. The minute that we try to disprove, as an initial strategy, try to disprove another person's point, we give them a free ride. And that's the mistake we're making. Okay? In the immortal words of Ricky Ricardo, who's Ricky Ricardo? They got a lot of splaining to do. Right? And so we want them to do some of the splaining for their own view. We want them to defend their view before we have a responsibility to refute it. You see, it's not enough to simply give an alternate explanation. Oh, I can explain that. And then people tell a story, okay? They've thrown their gauntlet down. What's a gauntlet? It's a glove, right? What does it mean to throw the gauntlet into the arena, throw it down? It's like a challenge, right? So when the medieval knight throws his gauntlet down, his glove into the arena, it's a challenge. That means he's in play, right? Okay, he doesn't then say, okay, fellas, I won. No, wait a minute. The guys say, you just got in. You just signed up. Now you got to put up or shut up, right? You got to show us what you got. And by the same token, when somebody comes up with an alternate explanation, I can explain that. And what they mean is they're trying to explain it away. All they're doing is throwing their gauntlet down. They don't get to back off like that and say, now I won. Because an alternate explanation is not a refutation of your view. Not yet. It's just an alternate explanation. They have to show why their explanation is a good one against your view. Let me say that again. They have to show why their explanation is a good one against your view. In other words, they have to shoulder the what? The burden of proof, okay? And this is what you're going to require them to do. I had a phone call, I took a phone call on a radio show here in Southern California. You all know KFI, right? Yes. More stimulating talk radio, all of that. Okay, so I've been on a couple of times, and once I was doing a Sunday night event a show where I was dealing with the issue of intelligent design and creation. And so I made my pitch, and then we had callers, and somebody called in and started invoking Big Bang cosmology against me. Now, I know this is controversial in Christian circles, all right, but it doesn't bother me at all, because my particular view is if there was a Big Bang, and I think there's good reason to believe there was, then it needed a Big Banger. Right? Big Bang needs a Big Banger. Well, that's on my side. That doesn't help them. That helps me. Right? In the beginning, bang! That fits. Okay, so in any event, backyard translation. So I made this point to the caller, and then the caller says, no, that's not going to work for you, and he's going to explain to me how you can get something from nothing. Okay, you with me now? How are you going to get something from nothing? Because that's the problem, all right? Because you had nothing, then you get something. Well, how's that happen? Well, if God's in the picture, no problem. But if nothing's in the picture, that's a problem. So he's going to explain it to me. So here comes the alternate explanation. And I have it verbatim from the show. Well, I don't think it is. I don't think it's a point for your side. Because you could start with a base of nothing, and then you could say that there was nothing but an infinite continuous moment, and eventually one tiny, little, insignificant thing happened. A point happened in the nothingness. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? How do you get a point in the nothingness? I mean, maybe it's a really small point, and it makes it easier. I don't know. But in any event, then he continues. It requires no intelligence, so no intelligent God had to intervene. All we need is a little, tiny imperfection in the perfect nothingness. Now, let me pause for a moment. You notice how when people get in conversations like this about the beginning of the universe and everything coming from nothing, they treat nothing as if it were something. We shouldn't use the word nothing. We should use the word no thing, because we're actually talking about no thing. Something caused the beginning of the universe. Yeah, what was that? That was the something was a nothing. Well, nothing is no thing, so it can't cause anything. And if there is no thing there, there can be no adjective to describe it. Right? So you can't, do you realize you cannot have a perfect nothing? But this happens all the time in these conversations, okay? He said, all we need is a little tiny imperfection in the perfect nothingness. And that imperfection expanded, it became variegated and increasingly complex, and soon you had galaxies and planets and everything spinning out here. So here's the picture. First you start with nothing, and the nothing is kind of like a placid pond, and then you get a speck of something from somewhere you didn't say, notice. And incidentally, that's the problem. Where does that little speck of nothing come from? I mean, something in the nothing come from. I'm making it sound harder than it is. It's not hard. So he just assumed it. That's all he did. He didn't show me anything. He just assumed it. And apparently this speck of something lands into the pond of nothing, and then it starts pitching and weaving and gets all annoyed and starts spitting out all of these planets and galaxies and stuff like that. Now, I got to answer this guy, and I'm on the air, right? And it's KFI. At nighttime, they run free all the way, clear all the way to the Mississippi River. Lots of people listening. So what am I going to say to him? And I'm thinking, this is Los Angeles. This guy's on drugs. But the way I answered it is I kept in mind the principle that I'm trying to teach you here. The person who makes the claim, what? Bears the burden of proof. And so I said, it's interesting how you started. I said, you started by saying, you could say that. And then you told your story. I said, you're right. You can say anything you want. But giving us reasons to take what you said seriously, that's another issue entirely, and that's your job. I had nothing to respond to because he gave me no reasons. He just told a bedtime story. That's what I call these things. People fabricate a story. They start out by saying, I can explain that. Then they tell a fairy tale to put your idea to bed, all right? And then they back off like they've done their job. Well, it's okay to start that way. I don't fault the attempt, but you can't stop there. You tell your story, and then you give your reasons for it. And if there are no reasons for it, no one has to take it seriously. By the way, this is true for both sides of the aisle, Christians as well as non-Christians. And so here's where our tactic comes in. So when somebody makes a claim, especially when it's controversial, then we are going to ask our second Columbo question. And here it is. Now, how did you come to that conclusion? Or some variation. What are your reasons for that? I think I understand your view. Now, what makes you think that's what actually happened? Do you see how you can just flex with that? But what you're doing is tossing the ball back into the other person's court legitimately. They're the one who made the claim. They're the one who's got to give the reasons. Very simple. Now, last time I told you when you ask your first question, what do you mean by that? That you're likely to get what I call the Simon and Garfunkel response, which is what? Sounds of silence, right. Because a lot of times people don't know what they mean by what they say. And when you ask for clarification, they just are kind of come up blank. You get the exact same thing here. When you ask the question, now how did you come to that conclusion, this presumes that the other person has actually come to a conclusion when in fact, to be honest with you, most people, non-Christians and Christians alike, most people do not come to conclusions. They hear what other people say, things that they like, that fits their desires or whatever, and then they just run with it and repeat it. They have not thought it through. So when you ask, how did you come to that conclusion, do not be surprised if you get the sounds of silence. Simon and Garfunkel again, okay? Let them sit on it. Let them think about it. I've actually had people tell me, after they've thought about it a little bit, they said, you know, I really don't have any reasons for believing that particular thing, which I think is an honest, candid admission, right? And of course, I had another question for them. Why would you believe something you have no reasons to believe? And I've had two people that have responded and said, I don't have any reason for that either. Right? Okay. We do not characteristically examine our beliefs, and you can take advantage of that just as others take advantage of it with you. You're in the driver's seat. You ask the question. And then you see what they've got. Notice here, just with these first two questions, which is the core of our game plan so far. This is their friendly conversation. We're showing an interest in other people's ideas. We are in the driver's seat because we're asking the questions, but we're drawing them out about their own views. We are not advancing our views, and therefore, if we're not making any claims, we bear no what? No burden of proof, which means we're not on the hook for anything. Friends, I am giving you a game plan that keeps you in the safety zone the whole time. You have a tremendous margin of safety here. And I hinted at this last week, but I'm going to say it directly this week. You will be stunned if you practice. In other words, if you put this into play, you will be stunned at how much progress you will actually make, even though you're not making a case. I realize I'm a little short on time here, but let me just say this really quickly. I was in Normal, Illinois, Illinois State University, that town, and I was with a having a conversation with a local professor who is a Christian, and he, a biology professor, okay? And so he's got to deal with the issue of evolution. And he would make his case against evolution in his class with his students, and they'd go back and forth or whatever. And then he read the tactics book. And then after he read the tactics book, he said, well, I'm going to try this out. Instead of having an argument with them, I'm just going to ask them a couple questions. And so when somebody raised the evolutionary thing and they talk about the origin of life, how did life come from non-life? How do you get living stuff out of dead stuff? This is a huge problem, by the way, for the naturalistic view. You got dead stuff, then somewhere you got living stuff. How did that happen? This is a huge problem, okay? So instead of saying, well, you're not going to get living stuff from dead stuff and making his positive case as a professor, what most of you can't do, because you don't have the training for that, he just said, okay, well, how does that work? How do you get living stuff from dead stuff? To a student. And he was having lunch with the student. And the student grabbed a piece of paper and he started writing down. He's going to explain now. So the student is now clarifying his view. He's just answering the first question. What do you mean by that, right? It's all that's been asked so far. The student, and the professor's telling me this. The student is writing down and explaining his stuff, and he stops midway in his explanation. He pauses, considers what he'd written, and then the student, the atheist, the evolutionist student, says to the Christian professor, this is actually better evidence for intelligent design. Let me try something else. So then he goes and he starts the second explanation. He gets a little way through it. He stops it, looks at what he'd written down, tells the professor, this is also actually better evidence for intelligent design. Now, let me ask you a question. What did the professor contribute to the conversation? Nada. Nothing. Next. Nyet. It's all the no's I know. All he did was ask a question, and he made progress with it. And this is what you're going to find out if you start doing this. And I promise you, if you start using these two questions, what do you mean by that, and how did you come to that conclusion? Just add that one in there now. Don't worry about doing anything else. Just go out in the next couple of weeks and just learn what people believe and why they believe it. There are two things that will occur to you very quickly. Here's the first thing. People are not as scary as you thought. Of those hands that went up, before, who started working with just the first question, how many had a good experience? See, it's the same number of hands, 7. In other words, everybody that tried it had a good experience with it. It's not difficult. And this is what I understand from people all the time. So you're going to learn that people are not as scary as you thought. When they are the other out there, the enemy, then they're scary. When you get closer to them, when you talk with them, when you engage, you realize they're just human beings just like you. They're not as scary as you thought. That's the first thing you learn. Here's the second thing you learn. They're not as smart as you thought either. Now, I'm not saying they're stupid. That's not what I'm saying. But I understand your tendency. You're like those, the spies that went out in the Book of Numbers into the land, and they saw the great land flowing with milk and honey, but 10 of them came back, and they said there are giants in the land. Remember that? And we were like, what? Grasshoppers in our own sight. We felt like grasshoppers looking at those big, scary guys. Now, two of the spies said, hey, let's go get them. They're not that big. They're not that bad. We got God on our side, right? But they wouldn't listen because they were already psychologically out of the game, all right? And sometimes we're in the same situation. We look at the opposition and we think, oh, I'm a grasshopper. Well, if you do this, if you say, what do you mean by that, and how'd you come to that conclusion, you're going to realize they don't have as good of reasons as you thought they did. And not only will you learn that, well, that's not a very good reason, but sometimes you begin, well, that's kind of a dumb reason. And he's a PhD. Now, don't tell him that or her that, as the case may be. But the point, so we're not, it's not about trying to make fun of people. That's not the point. Humans are humans, though. Okay? And a lot of times we believe what we believe, not for good reasons, but because of emotional things or biases or something like that. So when you ask these kinds of questions, it'll give you a better idea. Now, I have two more things to share with you quickly before I close. And that is, I want you to show you how you use these two questions in a very, I want to warn you against a ploy called the professor's ploy. And then I'm going to talk to you about how to get out of the hot seat, okay? Using all that we've learned so far, which is very simple, those two things, okay? The professor's ploy, well, look at it. There are lots of professors, the majority, I think, in not only secular schools, but even some so-called Christian schools, who have it as a goal to destroy the spiritual confidence of the Christians in their class. They'll tell you that. How many people are Christians in this class here? Beginning of the semester. Thank you. You won't be a Christian when I get done with you. That's what they say. I've had many students tell me this, okay? And then they take all these opportunities to beat up on Christianity and the Bible in their classroom. You know, the Bible's just a bunch of fables or something like that. And you're going to have some Christians in the class that's going to raise their hand, and they're going to push back and get in kind of a head-to-head with the professor. I get it. Now, I think it's right-hearted, but I think it's wrong-headed, because there's a rule of engagement that is violated when people do this. And here's the rule. You never make a frontal assault on a superior force in an entrenched position. They have a very sophisticated military word to describe what this is. This is stupid. Well, that's the S word. I can't use that. This is dumb. Okay, same idea. No, you don't want to do that. The professor's got you outgunned. He's in a position of strength. The man with the microphone's going to win, you know. So what do? I'm not saying you break off the engagement or the encounter. I'm saying maybe use your tactics instead. Because if you have a professor that's saying the Bible's just a bunch of fables, I don't know, if you're a student in the class, what question might pop into your mind right now that you could raise your hand and ask? What do you mean by that? Now, is that kind of question a challenge? No, this is the kind of question students are supposed to ask, right? And professors are supposed to be able to answer. So you're in safe territory there. After he's done explaining it, what second question might pop into your mind that you might ask at this point? How'd you come to that conclusion? All right. Now, the professor might figure out that you're one of those Christians who's sandbagging, and he's going to call you out. And this is where the professor's ploy comes in, that I want to protect you with. And this applies even when non-professors do it, okay? The professor might say something like, oh, you must be one of those Christians who believes the Bible's the Word of God. Oh, okay, well, look, I got a couple of extra minutes. Why don't you stand up and explain to the rest of the class why you don't think the Bible is a bunch of fables? Go ahead. Okay, so now what's the professor done? He has reversed the burden of proof onto the Christian. Why is that an illicit move in this circumstance? Because the Christian what? Has not made any claim. So bears no burden of proof. The Christian asks a question. There's nothing on him. When somebody says to you, after they've made the claim, you disprove me, do not take the bait. That's giving them a free ride. Now, what you might say in a situation like this, if you're a student, you might say, well, professor, you actually don't know what I believe because I never even said it. Maybe I even agree with you. I'm just trying to figure out what you believe, two things, and why you believe it. That's all, okay? Unless, professor, you just want us to take this all on faith. What do you think? No, I don't say that. But you get the point now. You do not respond because you're not making any claims. As long as you're not making claims, you're safe. You can stay out of play if you choose to. No problem at all. So there's where you can use your first two questions to avoid what I call the professor's ploy, but can be done by other people as well. Whenever anybody says to you, prove me wrong, don't take that bait. You say, well, wait a minute, you made the claim. You start. Burden of proof is on the person who makes the claim. Okay, here's the second thing I want to offer you before I get down, and that is I want to show you how to use these two questions to get out of the hot seat. Now, what is the hot seat, the way I'm describing it? That's a place where you find yourself in when you're actually talking with somebody, and let's say you're kind of in persuasion mode. You're advancing positive points for your view, which is just fine. It leaves you vulnerable a little bit, but I'm just saying it's okay. And then somebody starts pushing back, and what they end up doing is giving you a bunch of challenges and information you don't know how to deal with. And you're starting to stumble backwards a little bit, and you're thinking, oh, I can't deal with this. I'm outgunned. I don't know how to answer that. And you might even be thinking, gee, I wish I would have never opened up my mouth, because you're feeling uncomfortable now. So let me ask you a question. When somebody is coming on strong like that with ideas you can't handle, who is in the driver's seat of the conversation? You or them? They are, okay? And you're going like this, okay? You can change that in an instant, and here's how you do it. You're going to practice what I call conversational Aikido. You know, Aikido is that like self-defense where you use the other person's energy in your favor. You don't oppose them. You use it in your favor. So in a certain sense, you're going to say, all right, come on down. You want a piece of me? Come on down, right? This is what's going to happen here. And here's what it looks like. When you feel that, you're getting overwhelmed, you can't answer, you say to them, wow, it sounds to me like you know more about this than I do, and you have a lot of points that I don't know how to deal with, okay? I wonder if you could do me a favor. Could you slow down a little bit? I'm going to get out a pen and paper, and I want to take some notes, and I just want to get clear on your points, all right? I want to know two things. You can word this however you want, friends, but this is what you're after. I want to know what you believe and your reasons for it. Sound familiar? That's Columbo number one and Columbo number two. That's all it is. I want you to tell me what you believe and what your reasons are for it, okay? And basically what you're saying to them is, you want to beat me up? Okay. Just do it slowly and thoroughly, please. Right? Come on down. Have at it, okay? Now, by the way, when you say those things, you know more about this than I do. Slow down a little bit. Tell me what you believe and why you believe it. Now who is in control of the conversation? Who's in the driver's seat? You or them? You guys are. Just like that. And when you say that, do you have any responsibility to respond to the challenge? No, you've already said, I'm dumb. You're smart. I know nothing. I want to learn from you. And then you, after they tell you what they're going to tell you, then you say this. You say, that, now let me think about it. Let me think about it. Because when you say, let me think about it, you are completely off the hook. But we're not going to leave it there. Where are you going to take it next? What are you going to do? You're going to think about it. On your own, at your leisure, when the pressure's off. On your own, at your leisure, when your pressure's off. Then you can go to your books and your notes. You can go to your podcasts or your websites. You can call me on the radio if you want. I got a podcast and radio show 3 hours a week. You call during a live show, I'll do my best to answer your questions. That's one benefit, by the way, of listening to the podcast, str.org, Stand to Reason. That's the name of the podcast. Stand to Reason. You can get it on iTunes or at our website. But the point is, you can avail yourself of whatever information you need to answer the challenge after the challenge has been made, and you get it clearly. You get out of the hot seat, you get into the driver's seat, and you make productive use out of what would have been a very bad experience. Okay? Now, I want to make an observation. Watch this. I made a promise last week. I have just fulfilled the promise. I promised I would give you a game plan that would allow you to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you knew or how knowledgeable or aggressive or obnoxious the other person happens to be. And I've done that. I've given you two questions, two maneuvers, each with a question, that will allow you to converse in anywhere. What do you mean by that? Drawing a person out. How'd you come to that conclusion when they make claims? That's it. And listen, friends, that game plan will change everything if you put it into use. If you remember only one thing from our time together, always remember this. Take a tip from Lieutenant Columbo and always ask questions. Let me pray for you. Lord, just reading in the Gospel of Luke, Father, yesterday, how your magnificent son maneuvered with the Pharisees, always looking to trap him, maneuvered with questions. He was a master at it. Thank you so much for that example to us. Thank you for this this opportunity to learn a game plan that will help us to reflect you and be more effective for you as your ambassadors in the community. Father, I pray for my dear friends here at Calvary Chapel, Chino Hills, that they would take these ideas and just step out. Start putting them into play, and by your mercy and the power of your Spirit, you will begin to prosper that effort and show them the magnificent things you'll do if they have the courage to step out for Christ's sake with a plan like this for the kingdom. Amen.